When I was courting Eleanor, I told her Uncle Teddy I wouldn't run for president unless the job was steady. Don't print it, strictly off the record. We entertained the royalty, but we were never flustered. We gave them Yankee hot dogs with Coleman's English
mustard.
Welcome
to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan, here as always with...
Luke Savage, welcome back, folks.
Made it through the intro. We are one arts and culture institution that is not crumbling anymore. The same cannot be said for most other arts and culture institutions. We are a Toronto-based podcast. This week has brought news of two different mighty, too-big-to-fail Canadian arts institutions having trouble. I don't know if you saw this, Luke, but the Hot Docs Film Festival, which is the biggest documentary film festival in North America, they had their big press conference to announce their new festival this year. And the day before it happened, most of their programming team resigned en masse. 10 programmers. This has come after a couple of years of difficult times for Hot Docs. Theatrical exhibition for documentary films is not something that has really recovered after the pandemic. But beyond that, it looks like there's a lot of internal strife. The programmers put out a joint statement on social media saying, "Recently, the once welcoming programming environment was turned into a toxic workplace by 1, a lack of respect for protocol and business communication, 2, the dismissal and or diminishment of team members' voices, 3, breaches of contract across various programs. We were expected to work in an ever-changing, chaotic, unprofessional, and discriminatory environment. Programming team members approached HR, senior management, the president, and the board in good faith to share our concerns. There was an effort by all parties to work together until a request by the programming team for public transparency regarding the above concerns was denied." This comes the same week as a strike at the Art Gallery of Ontario, the biggest, the best art gallery in Canada. The Toronto Star reports, "Striking employees are members of OPSU Local 535, and they include assistant curators, archivists, food and hospitality staff, researchers, instructors, carpenters, electricians, and visitor services staff, among others. The union accused the AGO of, quote, shortchanging long-term loyal staff with an offer that does not reflect contemporary wages, unquote, after 10 months of bargaining. The union has previously said that part-time employees make up more than 60% of the AGO's workforce, and they earn an average of $34,380 per year. Quote, meanwhile, most top executives make north of $200,000 annually, unquote, OPSU said in a statement issued earlier this month. There are similar rumblings about other Canadian arts institutions. There are other arts institutions that have suffered enormous financial blows because their corporate sponsors have left them, typically citing economic concerns following the pandemic. It feels kind of apocalyptic, to tell you the truth, to see all of this happening all at the same time in Canada. It's funny that a recurring theme among all of them is that there seems to be an executive class in these institutions that's still earning like $200,000 or $300,000 per year, regardless of how well or poorly these institutions do, regardless of the recovery after the pandemic. And they're all staffed by these very precarious part-time or contract programmers or gig workers who are making, like $30,000 a year in the city of Toronto. You know, those are the ones with their ears to the pavement. Those are the people who know what's happening in the arts. And those are the ones who are really shouldering the burden of these economic tectonic shifts.
Yeah, I mean, everything you just described is exactly how universities now work as well. We have periodic strikes in the GTA at post-secondary institutions, and they've all basically come down to the same thing. Arts institutions, like most institutions these days, it feels like, increasingly depend on, like a permanent precariat of not just staff, but also, you know, TAs. Contract faculty is a big one, particularly at colleges as well, where, like people will teach for 10 years in an Ontario college, but they're never actually treated as staff, and they get their $32,000 Canadian dollars a year to teach, you know, a full course load and do all their own marking. And the number of administrators at all these institutions, not only are they paid absolutely crazy salaries, you know, in some cases approaching the mid six figures, but there's also just lots more administrators than there used to be. Like, there's a very top heavy bureaucracy now. I guess a lot of these things we're talking about are public institutions, but honestly, my sense is this is also true in the private sector too. like the way executive compensation is now worked out, where like sometimes there's sort of a token effort at these very big firms to pretend that, you know, it's linked to performance and stuff, but it's often not linked to performance at all. There's just a bunch of like rigged rules around how executive pay is going to be calculated. And yeah, just usually ensures that whoever's at the top gets a big payout. This is going back a bit in the conversation, but I remember way back in 2020, a few months into the first lockdown, a colleague saying that, you know, I think actually inspired by, or that, you know, I think the comment was prompted by a beloved local theater in their neighborhood closing after, you know, trying and failing to set up a GoFundMe to, you know, stay afloat during lockdown. I remember them saying, you know, the pandemic is going to kind of supercharge a lot of austerity that was already going to happen, but was going to take 5 to 10 years. And it does very much feel that way. It feels like, you know, we've come out of the pandemic, but not only are things not back to quote unquote normal, they've continued to get worse. It's very funny to keep seeing these takes from, you know, a certain kind of economist, a certain kind of, I don't know, Joe Biden partisan, where it's like, no, don't you people get it? The economy's never been stronger. The labor market's great. And it's like, look, buddy, all I know is that food is like 40% more expensive than it was before, and the rent is too damn high.
We're in the money. We're in the money. We've got a lot of what it takes to get along.
I'm not sure if that discussion was crescendoing to any real thesis, but I do
feel
like...
That's what they're
going
to call the book about our lives. I don't think it was crescendoing to any thesis, the Will and Luke story.
Nonetheless, I do think all of that very much describes the vibe of the present moment. And I don't know, maybe does relate at least tangentially to something I wanted to talk about before we get to our movie for the day, which is a real doozy. Now, yesterday, I wrote an article responding to a piece in the National Review. I don't often do this, but sometimes a piece, even a short one like this, this can't be more than about 500 words. Sometimes it just distills the essence of something, in this case of American conservatism, so well that I feel like it merits a response. And by the time this episode of the pod comes out, I think my piece at Jacobin will be up as well. But Will, you may have heard of this legislation Bernie Sanders has introduced to shorten the working week from 40 hours to 32 hours.
I think it's a great idea. And I think he should get it lower. Let's make it 8 hours. Let's make it 4 hours.
Well, I mean, it is in some ways quite conservative in its ambition. But I mean, yeah, basically the 32-hour Workweek Act does exactly as its title suggests. It, you know, would gradually over the next 4 years reduce the standard working week from 40 to 32 hours without any loss of benefits or pay. If you work beyond 32 hours, you know, now they have to pay you overtime. There's some specific provisions as well for, you know, if you work over a certain number of hours in a single day, overtime kicking in and such. But, you know, very common sense kind of legislation. And, you know, as Bernie pointed out in launching the proposal, American workers are quite literally 400% more productive than they were in the 1940s, but they're still working, you know, similarly long hours. And, you know, wages have been stagnant for decades. So when you adjust for inflation, you know, yeah, wages have theoretically gone up, but they've been so outpaced by inflation that the net effect over the last, you know, three decades, I think in particular, is that wages have basically stagnated. Now, all of this is just a preamble to this article in the National Review. This is by Rich Lowry, who's the editor-in-chief of National Review. The article is called Bernie Sanders Makes Marx Proud. And I think one of the things that I found so interesting is not quite the right word. I'm not sure what the exact word would be. But something that has long fascinated me about a certain kind of conservative media and a certain kind of corner of reactionary ideology is just how anguished and kind of hyper symbolic it's possible for this kind of article to be, you know, in response to something that is, you know, extremely modest and, dare I say it, quite conservative in a small C sense in its ambitions. So the whole article is only about, like I said, 500 words or so. I think I'm just going to read all of it. It begins, as a lot of National Review articles do, with some just sort of garden variety histrionics about, you know, Marx and communism. Karl Marx would be proud. Bernie Sanders has proposed taking another step towards the philosopher's envisioned utopia by proposing a mandate to a four-day work week. So right off the bat, it is utopian that when people have become 400% more productive, they work 8 hours a week less than they were before. Marx wrote how in communist society, workers would be liberated to hunt in the morning, fish in the afternoon, raise cattle in the evening, criticize after dinner, just as I have in mind, without ever becoming hunter, fisherman, shepherd, or critic. Needless to say, that's not how communism turned out. Yet the belief that work is basically a capitalist imposition that is unnatural and bad for people still holds sway on the left, and Sanders is, accordingly, proposing to move from a 40-hour to a 32-hour work week to make us healthy, wealthy, and wise. Now, I want to pause for a moment on this point, because Rich Lowry seems quite angry at the idea that work is basically a capitalist imposition. And, you know, we were talking about the pandemic off the top. I think it's worth recalling here, just on this point, all of the stuff that places like National Review and many a chamber of commerce put out about how damaging stimulus checks were to the U.S. economy. Now, why was it, Will, that the stimulus checks were so damaging? It's because they were removing the incentive to work. That was the phrase used. Now, it seems to me, if your trade is tossing around phrases like incentive to work, you then don't get to straw man the idea that plenty of the work that's done in America is a capitalist imposition. I mean, you yourself have literally made the argument that it's a capitalist imposition. You just think that that's good. So he continues, he quotes Bernie, says, "It's time to reduce the stress level in our country and allow Americans to enjoy a better quality of life," the Vermont socialist insists. "It is time for a 32-hour work week with no loss in pay." This is perhaps the key paragraph in Lowry's piece. He continues, "The last clause is the key one. If everyone can work less and produce exactly the same, why not? And if this is possible, why stop at 4 days a week? It'd be positively cruel to make someone work 4 days when they can work 3 days with the same outcomes." And I just want to say, Rich, you needn't continue. I completely agree with you. Extremely cruel indeed.
In here, and this is not a revolutionary point, is the assumption endemic in most conservative literature, which is that work itself is inherently virtuous, particularly for the caste of people known as the workers. There are some people who were put on this earth to work, and through that, they gain virtue. And I'm sure a writer like this would say, well, we all get our identities from work. I, as a writer of 300-word articles, get my value from work. But I also think part of him wouldn't chafe at the idea that, you know, there are workers, and then there are men of letters, and then there are also the leisure classes, and this is as it should be.
Well, I think that's very perceptive. Incidentally, the National Review, a bunch of their editors, you know, they were so incensed by this legislation of Bernie's that they seem to have dedicated a whole episode of their podcast to it. And I took note of a few of the responses from NR Online editors. One of them said, "The government really just makes a lot of things worse and introduces perverse incentives. We don't really need more incentives for people to kind of not work. I think there's already quite a lot of those. Of course, it is important to be working hard, and it's deep in our sense of dignity to do jobs, however humble they are, and to do them well." A little later in the broadcast, another editor named Charlie says, and, you know, forgive me, I don't know his last name. I'm not up on my current National Review editorial staff, even though I do check in on it pretty regularly. Charlie says, "I don't understand why the federal government gets any say over this. I also think that it is a ridiculous thing to want to do. Work is good. Work is good for people. If anything, we should work more. We are massively in debt." So yeah, just further to point you're making there, Will, there's some more cookie cutter right wing stuff I guess I'll skip over. He does eventually get to something resembling an economic objection to the idea, but, you know, it's very funny in a piece where he's constantly saying, like, the whole piece, the way it's framed is that Bernie Sanders is economically illiterate. And I mean, I don't know, people who live in glass houses. He continues, "What we earn is not an arbitrary number, but is linked to what we produce." I will just reiterate, in light of that claim by Rich Lowry, the statistic off the top. Wages are completely stagnant, even though workers are 400% more productive than they were in the 1940s. So clearly, what we earn is actually not linked to what we produce. To simplify, if everyone were to work work 20% less without becoming any more productive, GDP would decline 20%. The pie would shrink, even though Sanders is saying everyone else's slice would impossibly be just as big. He then goes on to talk about other countries who have implemented this impossible utopian idea. France already has a 35-hour work week. He says this stricture only applies to blue-collar workers. I'm not up on the details there. He says French workers make less money. I'm rather skeptical of that claim. Even if that's true, which I gotta say, I don't find Rich Lowry a credible source in that. I noticed there are no hyperlinks or citations in this piece at all. So you're not actually able to check any of his claims unless he delivers them in text. So he says that the net disposable household income in France, according to The Week, is $34,000 a year, whereas in the US, it's $51,000 a year. I mean, I would assume there that because he's using the average rather than the median, there's some wonky math or something. I suspect when you add in all of the social programs that France has that the United States does not, the average worker is in effect richer. Anyway, it's then that we get to what I think, certainly my favorite flourish in the piece, where he actually momentarily acknowledges Sanders's point about workers being more productive. And then it somehow becomes a springboard for the most insane sentence in a piece full of insane sentences. He says, Sanders complains that American workers are 400% more productive than they were in the 1940s, yet are still working long hours. Over time, though, we have worked less. In 1830, the average working week was more than 70 hours, and over the course of the next century, it dropped by almost half. I think that's absolutely incredible. He's like, workers are, they're 400% more productive since the 1940s, but hey, the 1830s, have you ever heard about that? There were children working in chimneys. It's such a completely bizarre point, and it's also in many ways belied by the fact that if Rich Lowry had lived during the 19th century, we can be absolutely certain that he would have been against reducing the working week from 70 hours or, you know, introducing laws around child labor or anything like that. It's also worth making the point, and, you know, it's a point I make in the piece, that, like, why did the average working week drop from 70 hours to almost half over the next century? Was that some random process that played out? Or was it because workers organized and successfully won victory after victory against the Rich Lowrys of the world who wanted to make them work longer hours for as little pay as possible?
Something you've brought up before is that a lot of people, you know, when they were unemployed during the pandemic and they got their installment checks that allowed them to, you know, think about things other than work, you know, some people got to, I don't know, for example, learn how to play the guitar or take up some new hobbies.
I remember one testimonial. This was from that subreddit, r/unemployment. I remember one that really stuck out for me was somebody who said they'd had like an awful, crippling, extremely painful nail biting habit for 30 years, and they'd been able to give it up in the span of like a week.
I have no point greater to make than it's sad to think of all the great things that we miss out on because so many people are forced to work hours that they don't need to work. Think of all the great things that we miss out on, and I'm thinking of a white-collar example here. All the people at their bullshit email jobs have to work between noon and five on a Friday. You know, to say nothing about all the other kinds of exhausting jobs people have to do.
I mean, particularly since, you know, the modern right has the audacity to, claim that something like the incredibly coercive modern labor market is actually like an expression of freedom. Like, it's great. You get to choose between one low paid job and another. Fantastic. But yeah, I mean, often lost in this is all of the human creativity, to say nothing of the happiness that is suppressed or kept in check by all of this. It's also just worth saying, I mean, this piece, and I didn't really have time to go into it in my response, it doesn't really deal with the phenomenon of you know, what David Graeber so famously called bullshit jobs at all. Like, I think you were kind of alluding to this in your example just now about, you know, white-collar office workers who, yeah, maybe have to make an appearance from 12 to 5 on a Friday, but there's not, like, you know, they might have one email to send at least for, you know, 6 months out of the year, and yet everybody just has to keep up this ritual. And it's particularly true of North American office culture, you know, less so, I think, in some European countries anyway, that there is just this kind of, you know, liturgy around work. And even if there isn't actually work to do, you're expected to, you know, be there and to punch the clock.
Yeah, because that's virtuous. And they'll say, oh, it gives structure to your day. Isn't it great that you have a thing to do during the day that gives your life meaning? And even if you don't like the work so much, you know, just the ritual of going in to do it. No, fuck that shit. You can find other things to do with your day. You can impose your own schedule. 9 a.m. to 12 p.m., you record. 12 to 5 p.m., you edit. Next day, 9 to 12 p.m., you research your other podcast. 12 to 5, you record your other podcast. Next day, you edit another podcast. Afternoon, you write an article. See, it's great.
Anyway, we can close out this discussion on Rich Lowry's piece in a moment. But yeah, I mean, it's very much worth underscoring here how much the conventional wisdom, I mean, even on, sections of the right anyway, was, you know, in the first part of the 20th century, the just, you know, technology was going to eliminate, you know, a lot of needless toil. It was going to give people more free time. I actually found a New York Times article from 1956 in which a utopian populist firebrand by the name of Vice President Richard Nixon advocated a reduction in the working week. In fact, he predicted that a four-day working week was on the horizon. And he said, these are not dreams or idle boasts. They are simple projections of the gains we have made in the last 4 years. In the not too distant future, the backbreaking toil and mind-wearying tension will be left to machines and electronic devices. I mean, Nixon was not a friend of, you know, the worker. But I mean, I think that kind of sentiment was just a reflection of a certain sort of, you know, post-war conventional wisdom. And if you look at early 20th century and late 19th century depictions of the future, at least utopian ones, the thing that you see recurring again and again is just people living these lives of leisure because there are machines that are doing all the work. Anyway, Rich Lowry closes, I think, quite tellingly by citing a book. He says, what Sanders misses, as the economist David Bonsen argues in his new book, Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life, is that work is good for us, indeed an inherent part of the human condition. And then he says Bernie's economically illiterate, the end. But I do think it's quite telling that that's how he closes it. Work is good for us, indeed an inherent part of the human condition. And I mean, to be fair, in a very qualified way, I'm perfectly willing to concede that point. I think insofar as there's something that can be called the human condition, it has room for leisure and it has room for work. I think there are very few people who actually earnestly advance the argument that absolutely no one should ever work or that work is inherently bad. The point is just that it's bad for people to have to spend the majority of their waking lives grinding away for not very much money in jobs that they wouldn't be doing otherwise when they could be spending time with their families, enjoying their lives, reading a book, or doing absolutely nothing at all.
Can I just say that the dichotomy between work and leisure is sometimes not always clear. For example, this podcast, we began it as a hobby. We've professionalized it. Nevertheless, this is still a pleasurable activity for us for the most part. We get to hang out with each other, friends. We get to do a creative project together. But there are days when it is work. For example, today, when we watched 2012's Hyde Park on Hudson.
The president wishes to see me.
I'd been invited to visit with Franklin at his home in Hyde Park.
Daisy, what a rad treat.
His mother said he needed to take his mind off his work and the pressures of being the president.
What do you say you and I get out of here? Go someplace quiet?
That spring, Franklin showed me a world I never knew existed.
Where's the police car going?
Sometimes they have to catch a crook or something, I suppose.
And soon, we became best friends.
Mr. President, they just left Beacon.
Good. It won't be too long.
No king of England had ever visited America before.
So nice of you to come.
Mr. President,
forgive me for not getting up.
So Franklin invited them here to the country where we could all relax.
Your mother has now told me for the 10th time not to call her Royal Highness Elizabeth.
Do you mind if I call you Elizabeth?
No.
I gotta tell you, well, I don't disagree with anything you just said. I mean, this movie was... I mean, the chore of chores.
Awful.
This is one of the most nothing movies, one of the slightest movies I have ever seen. Nonetheless, it is a testament to how much doing this podcast has rewired my brain that its nothingness became like a source of amusement by the end. And I'm actually kind of excited to talk about it.
Same. I have had worse experiences with things on this show. I mean, this movie is the pits. This is in the bottom quarter of movies we've watched, but it was amusing.
Yeah, I mean, this one, I mean, it's not at the bottom of the list, but for me, in terms of viewing experience and overall quality, you know, at least not counting sort of B movies and low budget things we've watched, I mean, this really is the pits. Yeah.
I would say that most things that we've watched on this show, even things worse than this, have had more of a valid reason to exist than this. There have been things we've seen that I have violently disagreed with, but that nevertheless, I think we're more entitled to be at the marketplace of ideas than this movie. Worthier subjects of debate.
Yeah, so this movie, which is called Hyde Park on Hudson, you know, you learn something every day. And when I woke up this morning, I had absolutely no idea that this movie existed. And I'll probably forget it by the time I wake up tomorrow. This is a 2012 historical drama film directed by Robert Mitchell, starring Bill Murray as FDR, also featuring Samuel West as King George VI, so the one who followed the Nazi who abdicated. The great Olivia Colman as Queen Elizabeth. That is the woman most of us know as the Queen Mother, and Laura Linney as Margaret Daisy Suckley, who is FDR's sixth cousin and a childhood friend of his.
And one of his stable, one of his menagerie of mistresses, as we find out.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of mistresses in this movie, though quite why that is, I'm still not exactly sure, but we'll come to that. To situate this movie as a viewing experience and kind of on a quality scale, I think the best way of characterizing it would be that this is a piece of Oscar bait that did not even succeed as Oscar bait. I think I have rarely encountered a film that is so obviously fishing for major awards, is so obviously projecting a sort of unearned air of, you know, middlebrow gravitas and self-importance, and so resoundingly failing to actually deliver even those things.
I mean, the fact that Bill Murray as FDR didn't get nominated for anything, didn't win anything, was never in the conversation for anything, represents an enormous failure, because never has a role been more tailored for somebody to win an Oscar. And in addition to it being a horrible movie from top to bottom, part of the fault is just old-fashioned miscasting. Bill Murray does his best. He works hard. He affects the FDR voice. He studied the mannerisms. Good for him. It is in many ways an admirable attempt. But I'm sorry, he cannot surmount the Bill Murray-ness of his being to effectively disappear into the role. There are some times when a very iconic actor will play another very iconic persona, and it sort of works because their charisma enters into conversation with the other person's charisma in an interesting way. One that comes off the top of my head is David Bowie playing Andy Warhol in the movie Basquiat. It's a bit of stunt casting that works because they both radiate a certain something. But Bill Murray as FDR, I don't know. It's a lot to swallow.
I gotta say, I do have an actual objection to the film's portrayal of FDR, rather to Bill Murray's portrayal of FDR. And I think the only way I know how to explain this is as a reflection of the film being British. But I mean, one thing that I do not think Bill Murray really conveys at all, or which, you know, the film's kind of conception of him does not convey, is the fact that FDR had a patrician breeding, and he had a kind of self-confidence and conviction that one would associate with that. Like, the film is very keen to portray him in what I think is a very British way as this kind of, like, vulgar yank who is actually, you know, sort of modest and self-deprecating. And FDR definitely did have that side to him, but I just didn't really find this to be a realistic depiction for this and for a number of other reasons. I mean, and that's to say nothing of the film's historical accuracy, which is, you know, fairly minimal.
Well, FDR is, of course, used symbolically in this movie to represent America, which in 1939 is both ascendant and also a little vulgar, a little down home, a little populist. This is a two-pronged story. One thread involves FDR's courtship of his sixth cousin, Margaret Daisy Suckley, played by Laura Linney. And Luke, as we were watching this movie, texted me to say, is this going to be a movie about FDR having sex with his cousin? Folks, yes. Yes, it is.
I mean, the only thing that is, like, weird and not kind of airbrushed about this movie is that the instigating incident, which also doesn't really make any sense, is that, you know, like, FDR, the president of the United States, you know, he's, like, been elected at least twice by this point. He's, you know, helping the country through the Great Depression. But, you know, he's also an ailing man. And for some reason, those around him are like, well, what do you do to help an ailing man? Why? You call up his sixth cousin who he hasn't seen in several decades. Get me the sixth cousin right now.
You know, there there are people you can hire to serve the function that FDR is looking for, but I guess they don't think of that. They have a first scene where she goes to visit him in his office, and, you know, it's a very grand, dramatic entrance for FDR, like she's being led into the inner sanctum. By the way, I was trying to, like, kind of put myself in the head of the hypothetical elderly audience watching this movie, being like, whoa, she's been led into the secret FDR chamber. Oh, wow, she's gonna meet FDR. I guess it'd be cool to meet FDR. But anyway, it's followed immediately by a scene where they go on a scenic drive through the country. He drives her to this beautiful poppy field where they look out at the flowers. And if you've heard of this movie, which is doubtful, but if you've heard of it, it's because of this scene where FDR leans back, unzips his fly, and takes what he believes is his. Without saying it, he says, okay, now it's time for you to serve your function in this transaction. Now, this is a movie that would not survive a post-2017 discourse cycle.
Well, but what's so weird about it is that the movie's portrayal of this is that it's romantic. Like, Daisy, his cousin, is totally into this. And she's like, oh, he'd come home and ask, you know, Daisy, where would you like to go? And he showed me roads that I could never have found myself and could never find after. And, you know, he told me that his wife didn't like to go on drives. So this is all played completely straight.
It's not clear exactly that there on a date, you know? So when he does what he does, in a normal movie, in a movie with sensible judgment, this would be like a dark moment. This would be the abusal of power scene. And that's kind of how it plays if you're a normal audience member. But for the rest of the movie, it's like, hey, now I get to hang out with FDR. Isn't this cool? I get to go see his country estate. Isn't that great? And the Laura Linney character, you know, she narrates the film. This belongs to a particular kind of Oscar bait movie, you know, like My Week with Marilyn or a movie like that, where the structure is a normal person meets the great man, you know, and it's all about the week they spent with the great man. And her arc, such as it is becoming not just comfortable with, but also loving her place as one of FDR's many side pieces.
Yeah, and again, I mean, the movie basically plays all of this completely straight. It's not really clear what we're supposed to make of the fact that, I don't know, there's like, what, five different mistresses portrayed in the film, most of whom, you know, when I looked it up, seem to have all been kind of rumored. Apparently, the real Miss Suckley did stay at the White House sometimes and apparently was instructed by Roosevelt himself to burn some of their letters. So that's, you know, there's been some speculation about that. We're also introduced to the character of Margaret Missy LaHand, played by Elizabeth Marvel, who amusingly will actually last appeared. You know, people will probably have seen her. I can't remember the name of her character in House of Cards, but she last appeared in that movie, The Congressman. She was
of course.
She was the female lead in that.
Yeah, I like that one.
shout out. Yeah, better movie than this. Shout out to Elizabeth Marvel, a hardworking character actor who pops up in unlikely places and is usually pretty good. But the real Marguerite LaHand was quite famously the private secretary and kind of almost the de facto chief of staff to FDR. And as I understand it, they were rumored to have some kind of a relationship as well, but it's not really clear. The film is sort of taking all of these pieces of speculation and just the fact that, you know, FDR did have real life mistresses. It's harvesting all of that and sort of weaving it into a fable, although what the point of this fable is never really made clear. I think it has something to do with hot dogs, which we'll have a lot to say about in a second.
Ah, yes. Well, the main structuring incident of the film is a visit from King George VI and the Queen Mother to Roosevelt's country estate. The king is there to sort of court Roosevelt, to take the temperature of the possibility of the U.S. entering a possible war against Germany on the side of the U.K. And actually, you know, that scene, the famous hand job scene, is important in the establishment of not just the FDR character, but in what the movie thinks is good about the FDR character, which is, this is a guy who takes charge. You may look at him and think that this is just a guy in a wheelchair. No, he's whipping out his phallic symbols, whether they be actual phalluses or hot dogs, and he's taking charge. And most of the second and third act of this movie are Roosevelt trying to convince the royal couple to each eat hot dogs at the big barbecue. And the eating of the hot dog will seal the special relationship.
Yeah, the hot dog, in addition to being a phallic symbol, is sort of meant to be symbolic of American kind of baseness and vulgarity. Like, the film rings so much out of, you know, the stodgy Brits being upset at, you know, the Yanks and their coarse ways. The whole thing watches like an episode of The Crown, you know, set a bit earlier and told partly from an American POV. I felt that the entire second act of the film was just these stupid little jokes that are structured around, you know, Yank Brit misunderstandings. Like Olivia Williams, who's also in this movie and plays Eleanor Roosevelt, like at one point she asks Elizabeth, "Can I call you Elizabeth?" And of course, Elizabeth is completely appalled by this. She's not used to this vulgar populism of this New World Republic. Later, the royal couple is offended, or at least the queen is offended, because there are a bunch of War of 1812 cartoons in their bedroom. We then find out that the president's wife has arranged for us to eat hot dogs at lunch. That's how the line is delivered.
Her function is to be Margaret Dumont. She says these lines over and over again. At one point, she says something like, "We don't make fun of us. Ourselves. You know, somebody just waiting to have a pie in the face.
So that's the setup of this movie. And by the way, all of that, which it's like, I don't know what, two, maybe three plot points, that's almost 40 minutes. Like, by the halfway point of this movie, virtually nothing has happened.
And wait till you see the second half.
Yeah, it was in the second half that I found true emptiness, that my mind was wiped clean and I experienced ego death. Absolutely nothing happens. By the 47-minute mark, which I think is roughly the halfway point, all that's happened is the king and queen have arrived. They've been offended at the vulgarity of their Yankee hosts. And it's still like the same night. Nothing has happened. They're having dinner. There's a scene where a tray collapses for no reason just before the soup. The king sort of starts to win people over. He's very nervous because of his stutter, and he makes a little crack. He says, "I suppose an angel passed by the tray, a very clumsy one." You know, nervous laughter. I'm not sure if we're supposed to think that that's a good joke or not. Didn't impress me, but really nothing about this film works or makes sense.
As we said, this is a piece of Oscar bait that didn't catch anything, and one has to assume that since it came out 2 years after the King's Speech, it was sort of pitched as like, this is the King's Speech 2. And one of the things that it's doing that the King's Speech did was, you know, take a historical incident involving King George VI and use this incident as like a synecdoche of, and then the war was won. You know, this one seemingly minor incident, whether it's in that movie, the king delivering a speech without stuttering, or in this movie, Roosevelt making the king eat a hot dog, like this one seemingly insignificant incident was actually crucial in defeating Hitler.
Yeah, which is also very funny because the United States didn't enter the war until December of 1941. And it wasn't because the stuttering king asked them to intervene. It was because the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one reason why this movie didn't quite catch on. The King's Speech, whatever its flaws, and there were many, did a better job selling the idea that this was a significant and indeed consequential event. As well as, I mean, the character arc in the King's Speech made a little more sense. You know, in this movie, the Laura Linney character arc, which is basically her learning to not just know her place, but also like it, the King's character arc is to get over himself just a little bit, you know, to like not worry so much. And actually, his other character arc is to learn a little bit of FDR's confidence, you know, to man up, to understand that he's the king and you don't vote for kings. So y'all better take it.
"You were wonderful tonight, young man."
"What do you mean?"
"Just what I said. You were graceful. You were confident. You're going to be a very fine king."
"I don't know what to say."
"Your father would be very proud."
"I'm not so certain about that."
"If I were your father,
I'd be proud.
That's right. And I'll come back to that point in a second because it's the crux of one of the key scenes in the movie. But it's worth just saying beforehand, like the Laura Linney plot, which the movie sets up as the main thing, essentially disappears for the entire middle of the film and then is only kind of haphazardly reintroduced at the end. So a lot of issues with this film, structural and otherwise.
And the two threads, the King George thread and the Laura Linney thread, they don't rhyme off each other. They don't complement each other. There's no productive tension generated between them.
No, I absolutely agree. Though it occurs to me, Will, since you brought up the King's speech, that the dynamic between FDR and the King in this movie is pretty much the same dynamic as the King has with his speech coach, right? Who's like a commoner in the King's mm-hmm. speech. And it's like in order to have confidence instilled in him, the King needs a dose of, you know, the vulgarity of a lay person who, you know, doesn't show the proper deference. That's very much the relationship the King has with FDR in this movie as well. And this is where the kind of, I think one of the key scenes, if not the key scene of the movie, comes in, where FDR kind of doms the King. Like they're having scotch or something or brandy after dinner. And FDR starts talking about how, you know, I think you're going to be a great King. If I were your father, I'd be very proud. The King then starts reading from a draft text of a speech and he's stuttering. He gets very, very upset and embarrassed about this. But then FDR, you know, pushes himself up out of the chair and pours himself another drink, just like with his arms. He's just bursting with confidence. And like the King can't believe his eyes. He comes back to his wife and says he thinks FDR is very, very funny. And he told me the kind of stories that, you know, we don't share with women. And she's very upset by this. He shares one story with her, which is some kind of like self-deprecating anecdote. And she says, we don't make fun of ourselves, Birdie. It makes us look ridiculous. To which he replies, no, babe, it makes us look human. Okay, I added the babe bit. But this is like the film just once again ringing like even more out of like, oh yeah, those stodgy Brits. Am I right, folks? Or I guess, you know, we stodgy Brits because it is a British film.
There's one more idea that this movie has, which is that this was a saner, more respectable time when we didn't pry into our politicians' secrets as much. It's pointed out that the press didn't take pictures of FDR being carried from place to place, didn't make a great deal of him being in a wheelchair, not only because they were more decent back then, but as FDR at one point says, you know, they're looking at me because they're seeing what they want to see. They're looking at me to represent something greater. They're not looking for, you know, the filth and the ugliness. In fact, getting ahead of ourselves, but the movie ends with Laura Linney in narration saying, in a time long ago, when the world still allowed itself secrets, Franklin Roosevelt was mine. And the implication, you know, much like that that awful movie about Gary Hart that we watched a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
With Hugh Jackman. Like the implication is, wouldn't it be nice if we went back to a time when we just minded our own business? We didn't care if our leaders were in wheelchairs or, you know, conducted affairs. Doesn't it speak poorly of us that we're here watching this movie about FDR's affairs? But we're watching it in a good way. We're watching it in an accepting, tolerant way.
I don't know if I've ever done this on the show before, but I want to draw your attention, Will, to another National Review article, this one by the Canadian newspaper baron and former felon, Conrad Black. This was published in January of 2013. And as far as I can tell, he seems to have basically liked the movie. I mean, the piece itself is kind of hung on, you know, Spielberg's Lincoln and this. And it's interesting because this is what he writes about Hyde Park on Hudson, FDR, and, you know, the very point that you're making. He says, in Hyde Park on Hudson about FDR, Bill Murray, generally known for comic roles, does a commendable job showing how Roosevelt coped with the immense pressures of his office as he pulled the U.S. out of the Great Depression while World War II threatened, and how he alleviated the additional tensions created by polio, his vulnerability to sinus attacks, his not altogether functional marriage, and his loneliness for affectionate female company. One can only wonder at the equable stoicism, ingenuity, and unshakable determination with which both presidents, Roosevelt and Lincoln, shouldered terrible burdens and conducted the country to successful conclusions, blah, blah, blah. He then continues a bit later. Fortunately, few presidents in the country's history could have been relied upon to produce the indignities of the Clinton era, the gaucheries of the younger President Bush, or the slippery confrontationalism of the incumbent, by which he must mean Obama. Lamentations of this kind are commonplace, and it would be unbecoming to dwell on invidious comparisons. This, by the way, is that kind of house style of a lot of right-wing publications where they just use a thesaurus way too much. Anyway, no more of it is worth reading than that. But it's interesting there that what Conrad Black seems to identify with in this movie is just the idea of sort of the great man, you know, coping with things. Like, you wouldn't think Conrad Black would be ideologically sympathetic to a figure like FDR. And I guess he probably isn't really. But he's sympathetic to him as like a great man in history because that's how Conrad Black thinks about history. And furthermore, as that paragraph about Clinton reveals, what FDR is to him, you know, it's sort of like what Kennedy is to a lot of people or various other analogous figures where it's like they're supposed to be, you know, symbolic of a, you know, lost age when, yeah, the president maybe still had affairs, but you didn't have to read about them in the press, which I guess by implication is the problem that Conrad Black had with Bill Clinton.
I think the movie has a lot of nerve making that suggestion when this is a movie about FDR's affairs. I mean, come on. Speaking of his affairs, the main dramatic flashpoint of the second half of the movie is Laura Linney being told of the full scope of FDR's affairs, being forced to be made comfortable with being not just one mistress, but part of a revolving series of mistresses. But quickly, she becomes okay with this. Really, it's kind of a polycule is what we're dealing with here. All the mistresses just enjoy each other's company. They play cards. You know, you get 4 o'clock, you get 6 o'clock. Not a lot of tension. There's one scene when it looks like there might be tension, but nope. Everyone accepts sexual liberation.
They both seem nervous. That surprised me.
Without some help from us, Daisy, there soon might not be an England to be king of. So I'd be nervous too.
There are a few more things worth mentioning in the final act. There's a bunch more hot dog stuff. For some reason, it's insane.
I cannot believe how much this movie invested in the hot dog as a symbol, as a dramatic device. The triumphant finale is King George eating the hot dog.
Yeah, the hot dog also comes in again earlier when Bertie being the king, is telling the queen about, you know, his cigars and brandy with FDR, and he says, "I asked without mentioning you about these hot dogs. What's that about? Do you want to know what he said? He said he doesn't get the fuss. They're just a good thing to eat at a picnic. There's no meaning. Nothing more." He's very amused by this. I don't really understand.
Food used to have meaning, man.
The queen, by the way, later in that scene, there's a bunch of kind of problematic scenes in this movie, but she later in that scene says of the dinner they've just had, "Did you see some of the people there tonight, Bertie? They're German, they're Irish, they're Italian, they're Jewish. They hate us and want to laugh at us." Which, you know, to be fair to the movie, is probably an accurate depiction of, you know, the ethnic prejudices of this generation of British royals and probably subsequent ones as well. FDR likes talking about his stamp collection. It's implied that he uses it to seduce women. How exactly that works is never really explained. There's an even later scene where the queen, still anguished at the prospect of eating hot dogs, pleads with her husband, "Bertie, are you really going to eat a hot dog tomorrow? Isn't that like having the PM over and serving him bangers and mash?" When they do sit down to dinner, there's a scene with this Cherokee drummer who's performing for them. And the movie, along with its characters, basically treats him like an exotic circus attraction. I did not love this. But yeah, you've already spoiled the ending, Will, or rather, you know, revealed its brilliance to our listeners. The king eats the hot dog, folks, and then he says, "Can I have another?"
USA, USA, yeah. USA.
And Daisy in a voiceover says, "And just like that, we felt America and England were back on the road to being very good friends." At least I'm told that's how some people took it. The king wrote in a telegram that when he got home, our two nations had forged a special relationship.
That's how I've been told some people took it. Some people are saying.
And yeah, that is how.
And can I also just say, my actual favorite part of the movie is after the final scene when text comes on the screen and says, "FDR eventually kept his promise, and by 1942, Britain and the United States were fighting shoulder to shoulder. And I gotta say, the word eventually is doing a lot of work in that sentence.
Yeah, eventually is kind of a load-bearing device in this movie in the same way that hot dogs are. I've never seen a movie rely so much on the symbolism of the hot dog.
So, you know, what can you say? Hyde Park on Hudson, nothing works. Failure from top to bottom. Everything it's trying to do did not succeed at. The ideas it's expressing, bad. The point it's trying to make, doesn't work. I'm glad that we dug this up just to bury it all over again.
When I go up to Hyde Park, it's not for just the ride there. It's not that I like Hyde Park, but I love to park and hide there. Don't print it, it's strictly off the record. I sit up in my study writing gags for Mr. Ickes and insults for the gentleman who'd love to slip him Ickes. Don't print that. Off the record. I scrapped the Prohibition Act when we required a bracer and finished up the Boulder Dam to give the boys a chaser. Don't print it, it's strictly off the record. And for my friends in Washington who complain about the taxes, who cares as long as we can knock the axe out of the axes? Don't print it, it's strictly off the record. I can't forget how Lafayette helped give us our first chance to win our fight for liberty, and now they've taken France. We'll take it back from Hitler and put ants in his Japans, and that's for the record.